Kildare Today.
With Whitewater Shopping Centre Newbridge. Get Christmas all wrapped up at Whitewater.
Special needs assistants perform very valuable functions in our school, performing support roles for teachers and active on a daily basis in classes, particularly primary schools right around the country, but also in some secondary schools as well. The increasing complexity of this special needs assistant role is being described as being outdated because the current perception of the role has not kept, or with the demands of the role since it was first introduced back in 1979. A recent seminar in the past couple of days has heard about the complexity of the role and indeed what would seem like a considerable disaffection amongst many SNAs about the way that they are perceived and indeed treated by the authorities, not maybe necessarily in our schools, but certainly by the Department of Education, I would imagine. Let's hear more now, because Shane Lambert is Assistant General Secretary of the Forset Trade Union, representing many of these special needs assistants. Good morning, Shane.
Good morning, Clem. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Now, a bit of background to this. This role was first introduced as far back as 1979.
Yes, it was introduced as a scheme back in 1979. And as a matter of fact, it still holds the same auspices today. It still technically is a scheme because there's never been a formal review. And it was deemed that at the time, three passes in the junior cert were the appropriate education qualification required to become a special needs assistant. Now, I mean, we can all hark back our memories to 1979 and imagine a very different Ireland and a very different world in which we lived in back then. Things have progressed, obviously, over the years in many different areas, and this qualification simply hasn't. It's never been reviewed. It's never been looked at. I mean, we know the progression that's been made in special education and in assessing additional needs and in meeting those additional needs of students. And thankfully, there's been a huge amount of very positive progress in that area. But it has also become a far more complex area. The more we understand, the more complexity arises. And unfortunately, the qualification remains stuck in time.
Now, your union force represents 80,000 members in public services, private sector, state agencies, community and voluntary sectors. And 800 delegates actually attended your seminar in recent days. And just looking at some of the messages, it was addressed by various people who are very experienced in the particular activity of special needs, including Caroline Quinn, Principal of Our Lady of Good Counsel National School, on behalf of the Irish Primary Principals Association. Indeed, we had them on Friday. One of your delegates tweeted, "Problems would not exist in the same way if there was truly respect and recognition of the value and the work done by SNAs. The job and the contract emerged in 1979. Jack Lynch was Taoiseach, postal workers went on strike for 18 weeks, and I had yet to be born," said one special needs assistant. Well, tell me something, how the role has become more complex, Shane.
Well, obviously, Clem, if you look over the past 40 years in terms of how we look at additional needs and how we treat additional needs, first and foremost, it's a far more inclusive school environment. There's a greater understanding of the vast spectrum of additional needs that exist out there today. And thankfully, there are renewed methods in terms of how we approach those additional needs. So if you think back to 1979, you know, there are individuals who would have been in the system then, if you like, or born then, or in the population then, who might have had additional needs but wouldn't have gone to school because the school simply wouldn't have been able to cater for them. The schools have progressed. The provision of service has progressed to a level now where we are looking at the future that we are looking at as a far more inclusive educational environment where anyone of any additional need will be able to be educated alongside their peers, you know, regardless, and they will have the proper support there to make sure that they can reach the proper potential. And this is where we've moved to, as I said, over the 40 years. But unfortunately, the qualification remains that somebody who has had three pass grades in a junior cert with 16 years of age, and this is not meant in any way derogatory to somebody who's done that. That's obviously a necessary part in an education journey. But, you know, a special needs assistant role would not be an appropriate role for a young teenager with no experience in anywhere else in the workplace who's just passed the junior cert with 3 days to walk in and to be able to meet the needs of those children. That's simply not acceptable. And the fact of the matter is, what we're looking for here is the reality on the ground to actually be recognised. So what I mean by that is, you mentioned Caroline Quinn of the IPPN. We had employers at that seminar on Saturday morning who were very clearly saying, we recruit at a level six. You know, we recruit. I think one of the statistics is there's only 2% of individuals who've gone through the UCD or who completed the UCD survey had the minimum of 3 days in a junior cert. And you could be rest assured that that 2% have probably got years of experience as a special needs assistant on top of that. And the vast majority of individuals that are being recruited into the system are being recruited in at levels that are far and beyond 3 days in a junior cert. And one of the contributors actually mentioned, I think it was one of our SNAs, and it's a bit of a paradox, but it's an interesting one to wrap your head around. Essentially, you're bringing in individuals into an education system who are to assist students achieve ultimately their goals in education in primary and post-primary level, when those individuals may not have or aren't deemed to need the same standard of education of the students that they're trying to impart knowledge and assist. And that really beggars belief.
It beggars belief that in 1979, three passes in the junior cert could get you this job. And I know it was 1979, but even then, because schools are very, very complex societies with a wide range of children. And they're even more complex nowadays, because aside from the various cohorts of special needs children and all the different conditions that have been recognised since and all the research in the appropriate ways to treat these children, I mean, staff training is an ongoing aspect of any particular job, particularly in caring roles. Do special needs assistants get any ongoing staff training or staff development?
Well, that's one of the sidebar issues, if you like, to this. Because the minimum education qualification is set so low at 3 Ds in the junior cert, then there really is no structured approach to continuous professional development or ongoing training. You know, it's very much on an ad hoc basis. Thankfully, there are some employers out there that assist and push. More often than not, SNAs embark on additional training at a cost to themselves. Which in many ways is fabulous, because it shows the dedication and commitment to the role they hold, which is second to none. And I'm not saying that just as a union official, but having been exposed to it for the last 2 years, having had young children start in school themselves, to see it firsthand really is something to behold. But it's not good enough in today's modern world that that's how it's left, that there's no consistency of approach, that there's no guarantee of additional education, that there's no guarantee of any type of career progression. If an SNA, you know, decides that their ambition is such that they want to progress in their careers to a level beyond where they're at, then they must move out of the special needs assistant sector, that they must move out of that role. And generally they move into teaching.
Do any or many of them reflect or react to a scenario which might persist? I don't know, I'm just asking this question. How are they treated from a professional perspective? Are they just treated as tidy uppers or just kind of childminders while the teacher does something else?
It can vary. It can vary from employment to employment. There's a considerable amount of schools in the state, and obviously there's different employers and different approaches. Some, and obviously we heard from some excellent contributors on Saturday about the value and the respect and dignity in which they hold their SNAs, and you know, the, how would you say, the stark reality of it, the understanding that they have of what they do. But we do have some, and we have dealt with issues over the past, certainly, past couple of years since I've been in the education division, where there is a viewpoint that, you know, it's a manual grade and it's a, what have we got to do for you today? You know, here's a mop and a bucket, here's some cloths, go out and clean the hall, here's a high vis jacket, could you go out and do car park attendant? And look, I'm not saying that in areas where there is a good working environment that there might not be an element of goodwill between an employee and an employer. That's the essence of any good workplace, you know, that there's that little bit of give and take on both sides. But there are areas where it is the employer that kind of almost in a very denigrating fashion, will dish out duties. But as I said, thankfully, it's not across the board. And more thankfully, the management bodies, the likes of the IPPN, who were there on Saturday, obviously have their view and they're putting their view forward, which is they hold the SNAs in a very high esteem and high regard. And that's the type of environment we want to work towards.
Indeed.
But we're not going to stop here. I mean, education is going to evolve. And you know, again, the research into additional needs and how we meet them and creating a more inclusive environment. So we would see this as safeguarding that role for the future. By professionalising it, you're safeguarding it, you're ensuring that there's a level of continuous professional development that's consistent across the board. It's not left to an ad hoc basis. And hopefully you develop leaders in this area who will go on to contribute into special needs education overall and be able to give their ideas. So we see this as a very big piece.
I think that's very, very well said, and what an important role it is. And maybe the next time parents visit their schools, they might recognise that special needs assistants are in effect professionals performing a professional duty and not just add-ons in the school educational system. Shane Lambert is Assistant General Secretary of the Force of Trade Union, reflecting on that webinar attended by 800 delegates virtually in the last couple of days, where they're reflecting on the current perception that the special needs assistant role is outdated now, the perception that is compared to a recent 1979. Imagine, 3 passes in the junior cert could get you into the schools. Schools are different places now, and that's not, by the way, meant at all as a disrespectful remark towards anyone who did the job at that time. Thank you, Shane, and good morning to you, Owen.
Yeah, we'll go to the Claymaynooth Municipal District now, and their meeting was held on Friday last, and joining me is Fine Gael Councillor Tim Durkin. Tim, good morning to you and welcome to the programme.
Good morning, and good morning to your listeners. How are you?
I'm not too bad. We were talking about schools there. There appears to be an issue in regards to lighting on the new road in Strafford from the National School towards Strafford Manor Housing Estate.
Yes, indeed. I've been contacted by a number of parents who live in the estates adjacent to the school, with little to no public lighting on that road. So obviously put down a motion. It's been added to an analysis of street lighting, and if funding isn't available, I'll be putting forward LPT money to get the issue resolved.
Okay, you also had a question wanting the council to confirm if and when a traffic analysis can be carried out in Kilcock, given the long delays experienced there on a regular basis.
Yeah, this is a kind of an ongoing issue, I suppose, and traffic has been backed up as far as the North Kildare Club between Maynooth and Kilcock on occasion. So it has been added to traffic management surveys. The survey will be carried out, and then if the timing of the lights needs to be changed or if other measures need to be taken to alleviate the situation, they will.
Okay, and then finally, Tim, can the council provide an update in relation to the relocation of the fire service in Maynooth Town?
Yeah, so we acquired a site on the Strafford Road as a more suitable site for the fire service to operate from, not having to go through the main street and a huge amount of traffic to get to any emergencies. So good news, the site was acquired nearly 2 years ago now at this stage, and funding application and design will go ahead in 2022. So looks like they're on the move to a better location.
Okay, some good news there coming from the Claymaynooth Municipal District meeting took place last Friday, and with those motions brought forward, Fine Gael Councillor Tim Durkin. Thanks, Tim.
Now, just a quick message before we go to the break, and we don't usually do lost and found, but somebody could be going around, I think, in a little bit of difficulty at the moment. Can you ask Clem if it's okay, would we be able to announce an expensive pair of glasses was lost last Thursday between 11 o'clock and 2 p.m. in the afternoon in Newbridge, between Dunn's Stores, the Courtyard, and the new Aldi store. It's for my father-in-law, and he misses them a lot. If a finder can, if anyone finds them, would they drop them into the Garda station in Newbridge? Or we have a number here, by the way, if you found a pair of expensive glasses, because this poor man might be going around squinting his way over the last couple of days. Lost on Thursday last, between somewhere in Newbridge, between Dunn's Stores across the Courtyard Shopping Centre and the new Aldi. If you found them, drop them into the local Garda station where it's been reported, or if not, give us a shout here and we'll be able to reunite Gentleman and his glasses.
Kildare Today.
With Whitewater Shopping Centre Newbridge. Get Christmas all wrapped up at Whitewater.
Okay, welcome back now. We'll take your messages during the course of the morning. The usual sources. Clem, somebody says, what's that? Mickey Mouse H-Dip got you into the teaching profession, whereas now it's a full-blown degree or master's. I'm at a loss as to know what is the job description for today's special needs assistants. Well, yeah, the Mickey Mouse H-Dip, as you describe it, Seamus, didn't just get you in. You had to have a primary degree as well. But I take the point that then it was a one-year course called Higher Diploma in Education taken at university level, which then completed the qualification to teach in the schools. And nowadays, you have a full-blown degree or master's degree. Yeah, it's quite incredible what happened. Now, the job description for today's special needs assistants, I'm not so sure, actually. That's an interesting point, and it's something that we might look up on when a special needs assistants post is advertised. What, in fact, are the requirements for it? Because certainly we've moved on since 1979, when three passes in the junior cert would indeed get you into that. Now, let's move on, because I'm joined by Michael O'Brien of the Fisheries Campaign Lead for the International Transport Workers Federation regarding this recent migrant documentation scheme, which has been introduced by the Minister for Justice, Helen McIntyre. But it's claimed that major anomalies must be addressed before its launch to avoid unjust exclusions. Michael, good morning.
Good morning, Clem. How are you?
Yeah, you might tell me about that particular title, Fisheries Campaign Lead.
Okay, well, just the International Transport Workers Federation, which is the organisation I work for, is the global umbrella body for trade unions that organise in the maritime and logistics and transport sector. So in Ireland, CIP2, Unite and Forsa are affiliates, but my specific role within the ITF is the fishery sector. I have colleagues who work in the merchant marine, the bigger ships, whereas my focus is particularly the welfare and the rights of non-European migrants who work on Irish flagged fishing vessels, both documented and undocumented.
How widely, we know, for example, I know that people are documented, and there are stories or assertions at times that these workers, if they're working on Irish vessels, are often working in, you know, at rates far below what the native Irish fishermen or women, I suppose, as well, might be working. Is that still prevalent?
Well, it is. They're more than assertions. I mean, only a month ago we had a ruling from the Workplace Relations Commission. It was covered in the Irish Independent newspaper there a week and a half ago, of a €20,000 award for an Egyptian fisher for non-payment of wages and compensation for overwork. So, and there's other Labour Court and Workplace Relations Commission hearings to come, and I anticipate there will be similar rulings made. So I would say it's fairly established fact. And as well, Maynooth University Law Department did a report there that was published in mid-October based on interviews with fishers from Egypt, Ghana and the Philippines who work on Irish flag vessels. So overwork, like long working hours, up to 20 hours a day, is not uncommon, and consequential underpay as well for both the documented and undocumented fishers. So yeah, it's still a very persistent problem.
That's specific to your industry, but the legislation that's been introduced, we're told, an estimated 17,000 undocumented workers will have their status regularised in this country, and we know they're right across the sector, and of course we know that many of these undocumented workers are open to exploitation and are very vulnerable, are they not?
Absolutely, and I think the figure of 17,000 is the best estimate out there about how many undocumented workers there are. Now, the question really is how many of those 17,000 will have a clear path to being regularised through this scheme? And my sincere hope is that the vast majority will. I suppose my main concern is that among the fishers that I'm acquainted with who are currently undocumented, most of them actually won't meet the criteria of the scheme. And these are fishers who've been in Ireland for longer than 4 years, and the scheme requires you to have been in Ireland for more than four years.
Why will they not meet the the requirements?
Because the way the scheme is set out is that they say you have to have been undocumented in Ireland for 4 years or more, and therefore there's an implication that if you've been in Ireland for 4 years or more and have been documented within the last 4 years, even though if you're currently undocumented, you cannot qualify. So I realise that that's a bit complex, but just to put it in real terms.
Yeah,
would
you put that in plain English, because that's gone over my head, but it's actually 3 years if you have children, I understand.
3 years if you have children in the state. But say, I spoke to an Egyptian guy on Saturday who's been in Ireland for 8 years. He originally arrived undocumented, and then when the permit scheme that specific to the fishing sector was introduced in 2016, he was enrolled by his vessel owner. So he was documented, and then the vessel owner cut him loose in August this year, so he became undocumented again. Now, he cannot avail of the scheme because he was documented within the last 4 years, because the scheme, they say you have to be undocumented for 4 years. So he's saying to me, Michael, how is that fair? You know, I've tried to play by the rules. The vessel owner decided not to renew the contract. I managed to get work on an undocumented basis with another vessel owner, and he has crewmates, our ex-crewmates, who have been undocumented for more than 4 years, so they can go and get regularised, whereas he should out, despite being in Ireland quite a long time. So there's all these little anomalies they're not little, but they're very big for the guys.
Explain something to me there, Michael, if you would. When somebody has been working, like that gentleman you talked about from Egypt, and was documented, and then when he's no longer required to work in that job, are you saying that he automatically then becomes undocumented?
Yeah, you see, there was a scheme introduced in 2016 specific to fishing. It's called the Atypical Work Permit Scheme for non-European fishers. And the way it works is that a fisher can be brought in with the approval of the Department of Justice by a vessel owner, be brought into Ireland. And they get annually renewed, like one-year contracts. And the visa that they get from the Department of Justice, it's called the Visa Stamp 1. And basically they're tied to the particular vessel owner, and then it's at the whim of the vessel owner to renew that contract on an annual basis or not. Now, if either the contract comes to a natural conclusion at the end of a year and the vessel owner decides not to renew, or if something happens mid-contract that severs the relationship, often it's injury. Injury is the biggest reason why the employment relationship ends. The fisher has a 28-day window to try and locate an alternative vessel owner to employ him under the terms of the scheme, or else effectively to become undocumented. So what often happens, Clem, is that because of the overwork regime, that there's a prevalence of back injuries, hand injuries, even catastrophic injuries like loss of fingers, the fishers then have to recuperate, and typically the vessel owner will just cut them loose. And the vessel owner will have moved on and employed somebody else to fulfill that role. And by the time the fisher recuperates, they're undocumented and they have to go around odd-jobbing on other vessels on an undocumented basis.
Where, of course, they're open to being paid at much, much lower rates and et cetera, et cetera, and being exploited.
Well, it's kind of a standard. You see, the issue is that the rate that's going to become prevalent and standard is minimum wage on a notional 39 hour week. There's like a standard kind of approved contract. And the contract basically says that it's based on an average notional 39 hour week, but the fisher ought to be paid for every hour he works, but the reality is that they all tell me is that they work, you know, anything from 15 to 20 hours on a day. Like that particular example I gave where the Labour Court made a ruling a few weeks back, the fisher in question worked 17 hour average days.
My God.
And the legal maximum is 14. And
right.
That's in a given day. So hence the prevalence of injuries and all that. So basically what we're left with is that we have a kind of a cohort of fishers who are currently undocumented, but they were in the scheme at some point within the last 4 years. And the fact that they were documented within the last 4 years excludes them from applying for this regularisation scheme. The other issue that we have is there are fishers who have temporary status because they've been accepted by the Gardaí into the National Referral Mechanism for Suspected Victims of Human Trafficking. So since 2016, 32 fishers have been admitted into the by the special unit within the guards, the anti-trafficking unit, into their referral mechanism for suspected victims of human trafficking. So this is the same scheme that's set up for sex workers, for others who are brought in and so on. And when they're admitted into that scheme, they get a special temporary stamp that's renewable every 6 months. And then, at the conclusion of the investigation, or if there's a prosecution or whatever, they may be called as a witness. But at some point, it comes to a conclusion, and in theory, their permission ends and they go home.
Now, you want that protection extended to cover the workers in your sector as well?
Well, I'll give you an anonymous
just briefly,
case. There's an Egyptian fisher was admitted into the referral mechanism for human trafficking this year. And he was in Ireland since 2007. So he was in Ireland for 14 years, was never documented. And under different circumstances, had he just hung on and endured the abuses, I would say, at the hands of the vessel owner, right up until now, or January when the scheme opens, that he would have been able to plot a course out and maybe get a... This scheme where it comes with a visa stamp for, and that visa stamp for enables you to work for any employer in any sector, so it's seen as highly advantageous, and it's a 2-year stamp as well. So he could have, plotted a way out that way. Whereas because he's been admitted into this scheme, he has his rolling 6-month renewable stamps, and then if the investigation ever happens, then that's that. Just the last thing I'd say, Clem, is that the other kind of last anomaly that I mentioned is that those legally documented fishers that I mentioned, that they're the ones that are on this stamp one, tied to their vessel owner, and they're looking at this scheme and saying, actually, this scheme is more advantageous. It's offering something more advantageous than what they're currently enduring, because, as I say, they're tied to the one vessel owner on an annual renewable contract, whereas, say, they have an undocumented crewmate on the same vessel who's never been documented. That crew member can go and apply for this and get a more advantageous stamp than the documented guy, and go maybe leave fishing, go into construction, as some of them do, if they can't move on legally.
All right, Michael, I'll have to leave it there, Michael, because we're just running out and have another guest to get through, but it's certainly very, very strange, and it's an incredibly hard-working industry. I mean, the conditions at sea, and we wish indeed everybody safe fishing.
It is, I just say, Clem, the minister has a month maybe to iron some of this out. This is fixable in the coming weeks. It can just be made a bit more inclusive and simplified. And we can, so it won't end up in the courts, really. That's the point.
All right, Michael, on that of the International Federation, Transport Workers Federation, on that issue of migrant documentation scheme is welcome, but major anomalies must be addressed as the union before the launch to avoid the unjust exclusions which have been described by Michael O'Brien there. Michael, good talking to you. Thank you for that. And indeed,
thank you,
we wish
much.
All your members the very, very best in terms of the weather that's forecast over the next 48 hours to 2.5 days or thereabouts. Okay, Colette Bennett, good morning to you.
Good morning, Clem. How are you?
Economic and social analyst with Social Justice Ireland. And you've just released your latest research, Colette, on what you're saying. Health inequalities persist and undermine treatment and care. Indeed, on this programme on Friday, we spoke to 3 different mothers whose sons all have spina bifida and other complex conditions, and whose vital surgeries, which are crucial to them as they develop young boys, some of them waiting 3 years for these surgeries and nothing happening, with many in the healthcare sector being marginalised due to the COVID pandemic. Your document, which has just been published, says people should be assured of the treatment and care they need in their times of illness and vulnerability.
That's absolutely right. So what we have focused on in this document is the inequalities that persist notwithstanding COVID. So, obviously COVID has had an impact, but we had a difficulty with our healthcare system long before COVID came into being. So we know, for example, as of March, we had almost 630,000 people awaiting treatment as outpatients. So those people that you're talking about from last Friday would likely be included there.
That's almost 3 in every 10.
And almost 3 in every 10 of those people have been waiting for 18 months or more. Absolutely.
Yeah, and I also see in your report that Ireland remains the only Western European country without universal coverage for primary care, and yet we're pouring billions. Where is it all going?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very interesting point. And I mean, primary care is very dear to our heart. It's something we've been advocating for a very long time. We have an exceptionally high amount of money going into the healthcare system, and yet we have a very low rate of care in terms of the provision of beds and supports for people. And as you said, you know, a very, very low coverage in terms of primary care. This is something we've been calling out for quite some time, and certainly in the last number of budgets, we've been looking to have more answers, more transparency around where the money is actually going, because it's never enough to look for both the existing levels of service and the commitments that government consistently make. So what we're looking for as one of our recommendations is that is made much clearer. But really, when it comes down to people and what people need and want, we're looking at more around, as I say, primary care, but also in terms of mental health. We know for a fact that we're going to have a mental health issue coming out of this pandemic.
We surely are. I'm going to move on to your recommendations in a moment, but people might want to hear this because I find this staggering, that Ireland's health system is ranked 22nd of 35 countries in 2018. But on the issue of accessibility to the health system, Ireland ranks worst of 35
right.
countries. That is just mind-boggling, when there is more money going into the health sector in this country than any other. We're told that, for example, certain groups continue to experience health difficulties. We're the worst of 35 countries in terms of accessibility. It all sounds like third world, Colette.
Yeah, Clement, it is very, very difficult. I mean, you know, from that report that you mentioned there, the Health Consumer Powerhouse, where you mentioned the fact that we rank 22nd out of 35 countries and accessibility were the worst, it actually went on to say that even if we've reached the government's target of 18 months or below in terms of waiting lists, we'd still have the worst waiting lists in Europe. So, I mean, that is nothing to aspire to. We aren't being ambitious enough around our healthcare system.
So let's look at some of the policy priorities that you're talking about. You talk about budget. Let's make sure budgetary allocations are valid. We'd like to know where all that money is going. The rollout of community health networks. Ensure that medical card coverage for all people who are vulnerable, and end the current hospital waiting list. Now, there's an aspiration when you look at numbers of 600,000, 700,000 in terms of waiting lists. We're talking about years, Colette, years and years before that will be ended.
Well, it doesn't have to be that way. If we had more input into the primary care sector, so we'd had more community healthcare networks, we had a greater and a more expansive GP and public health nurse network, that would actually take a lot of the pressure off our acute services, our hospital services, and leave those beds for people who actually need them, and have more appropriate care then for people who can be seen in the community.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned mental health. And you say we need to properly resource and develop mental health services and facilitate campaigns giving greater attention to the issue of suicide.
Absolutely. I mean, if you think, and you know, it starts with children. If you look at over 2,000 children are waiting mental health supports at the moment, and 1 in 10 of those have been waiting for a year or more. I mean, we need to dramatically reduce that. What we've seen from the research in terms of the impact of COVID, for example, is that between job losses and the stress that goes with that and the financial implications that brings on to people, we have people in very precarious jobs, we have people in very precarious housing situations, we have people who are experiencing domestic abuse and domestic violence, who were forced over the course of the pandemic restrictions to spend even greater amounts of time with their abuser. That has to have an impact on mental health, and we need to see huge increases in investment in relation to mental health support.
And I know you're also calling for universal health care for all. There's a dream, I'll tell you, in terms of the statistics that we've just mentioned there. To remind people again, Ireland's health system ranked 22nd out of 35 countries in 2018. But on the issue of accessibility, we're the worst of 35 countries. On 628,756 on waiting lists, almost 3 in every 10 are awaiting treatment on that month in terms of March 2021 and so on. Staggering statistics, I have to say. The latest research by Social Justice Ireland, publishing its Healthcare in Ireland policy